Good afternoon, folks. Welcome. My name is Phil O'Hara, and I'm the convener for the session, which mostly means I'm just going to hold the clock. I had read the sessions, and I'm really quite interested in what we're here to talk about, particularly with these specialists on teaching effectiveness that are joining us today. So it gives me pleasure to introduce Chuck Zerbin and Patsy Moskal. And I didn't know that there was a third presenter here today, but Gardner Campbell. So I ask you to welcome them and let them get started with their presentation, because I understand that they go right up to the timeline. But just before turning it over to them, we really would like that you complete evaluations on the sessions. And you can do that at any one of the email kiosks. There's a link directly there. Or if you log back into the EDUCAUSE site, there are links to the sessions there. And you'll also be mailed out general reminders about the whole conference within a couple of weeks. But for the benefit of the presenters and get some feedback on the session, really would like you to go and make sure you do those evaluations. No further ado, please join me in welcoming our presenters today.
Well, thank you very much. You may want to save that till after. You may not, you may be able to take that back. Hi, I am Chuck Jubin from the University of Central Florida, my colleague Patsy Moskal. We work for the Research Initiative for Teaching Effectiveness. We have two jobs. One is to evaluate the impact of technology on our faculty, students, and institution, and two, to support the scholarship of teaching and learning within disciplines as it relates to technology on our campus. We have my good friend Gardner Campbell from Baylor University, and Gardner Campbell and I spend our time bending each other's minds. We let each other know what we're reading, and his being here today is a function of something that you'll see later that we discovered surreptitiously as we were preparing for this session. So again, thank you very much, and we will try to move along. For those of you who've come to see a typical Chuck and Patsy show with it heavily data-oriented, there will be data in this presentation, but it will not be the usual kind of thing, so I hope you're not disappointed. Fundamentally, the session is about the student voice. We're very interested in the student voice, and we're noticing as we go along into this millennium that the agency associated with the student voice is growing stronger and stronger and stronger on our campuses. This session is also about student satisfaction with their online learning experience, the way it is motivated by ambivalence. And I'll be spending a lot of time trying to develop the concept of ambivalence. And I think you can relate to the concept of ambivalence this afternoon. It's 2:30. It's been a long day. It's a session. You're not sure what the title is. You have some ambivalent feelings about coming here this afternoon. You know, you do have some, yeah. And we have traveled 5,000 miles, you know, a long way to do this. And actually, we have a few ambivalent feelings about doing this. We're glad to be here, but you know what I'm saying. You know what I'm saying. It is everywhere, okay? It is everywhere. My favorite comment on ratemyprofessors.com is, this guy is so boring, my pillow needs a pillow. Well, that's an interesting statement. That's an interesting statement, okay? We have done a lot of work at the University of Central Florida trying to find out what it is that students view as excellent teaching. It's important to us. And we've identified something in a paper we call Dr. Fox Rocks, because you know if they like you, you rock. If they don't like you, you don't rock. There's a great quote by St. Augustine. If your teacher's in here, you've experienced it. I thought I understood it until I tried to teach it. Has that ever haunted you? It has certainly haunted me. I've been up there talking when I've known I don't have any business talking. I don't have any business talking. We are collecting an interesting narrative at the moment. We are asking our faculty to share with us the one comment that a student has written about them in their student evaluations that has stayed with them their entire lives. You each have one. You each have one. We have several. I have two that stay with me. One is a student wrote to me, Chuck Jubin is a very smart man. He may be even as smart as he thinks he is. Stayed with me my entire life. Don't be arrogant. Don't be arrogant. The second comment preferenced with the St. Augustine statement and said, Chuck, I've noticed something about you in your teaching applied multivariate statistics. When you're absolutely sure of your material, you can drift down the river into the eddies, back into the mainstream, and you have no problem at all. When you're less sure of your material, you start covering material, and your body language extinguishes questions. Now, that's not true, but that's what they said. So With that, the student voice becomes extremely important. Gardner and I have both been on the University of South Carolina campus. And I made a statement there that I worried about the critical thinking skills of the next generation. And I got an email. I'm going to read it to you. Excuse me. From a student at the University of South Carolina. Dear Chuck, you know this is going badly. One of the things you said about next generation students is that they have suspect critical thinking skills. An example you use is they cannot analyze a Russian literary figure. Is this really the correct way to measure whether or not someone of my generation has critical thinking skills? I will agree with you that most of us cannot analyze complex textual material, but how relevant is that to our daily lives? If our livelihood depended on telling you the literary motifs of 18th century Spanish literature, we could do it. However, our critical thinking skills have been diverted to things that are more relevant to our daily lives. For example, using an Excel spreadsheet. As you said, someone of the mature generation, okay, might sit down and read the manual for a new cell phone. My generation will learn by interaction with the phone itself or through a social network, not by isolating oneself and passively reading the narrative of the manual. On a show like 24, there's an enormous social network one must follow in order to understand what is happening. In video games, must manage a large number of sub-goals to produce multiple paths to a solution. My main question to you is this then, Chuck. Okay. Is the current way or definition of measuring critical thinking skills outdated? Perhaps critical thinking skills should not be measured by the ability to analyze David Copperfield, but by the ability to use all the features of your new cell phone. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? We published it for her. We published it for her. So we're talking about this notion then of ambivalence, feelings of ambivalence. Well, and satisfaction. This is a wonderful quote. The notion of the fact is it seems rather simplistic to think about measuring satisfaction in a straight line continuum. Who, after all, haven't we had all kinds of conflicting feelings about everything in our life? Just about everything's in our life, you know. When I listen to our political candidates in Florida, I have monumental ambivalent feelings. If I were to rate them on a singular scale, there's no possible way I could do it. Okay. The cat. Story of personal ambivalence. I grew up in upstate New York in Clark Mills, New York. It was a mill town. My father is dead, but if he could see me buying a cup of coffee for $4 with foam on it, he'd kill me. He would kill me. Okay? I grew up in a mill town. I went to school in a very preppy town, Hamilton. I grew up in Clark Mills, New York. It was preppy. I wanted to be preppy. Unfortunately, I was blue collar. I was blue collar. I wanted that desperately. So, what's the way to become preppy? What is the way to become preppy when you're blue collar and poor? Well, what it is a Jaguar. Get a Jaguar convertible. So what I did is I worked. I worked in the mill. I worked in my father's garbage route. I did everything I could, and I bought a Jaguar convertible. And I was cool. That was my idealized model. That was reality. That was the Jaguar I bought. Okay? That was the Jaguar. And it was really wonderful. You know that throaty feeling, that dual overhead camshaft, you know, the way it cornered. It was just great. And I sat in that thing and I was cool. Except if you know old Jags. They quit. Parts fall off them. It left me the night of the senior prom. My father had to come get me. Okay? That was my Jag. So, and for me to rate that car on a singular scale would be impossible because I love it and I hate it. 2 years ago, I went to buy a new car. So where did I go? I went to the Jag dealership. I sat in that beautiful Jag and I turned the handle on the radio and it came off in my hand. It came off in my hand. And all those old ambivalent feelings right back again. I will always love Jaguars. I will always hate Jaguars, you know, and doing this. Okay, now, that's where we are. That's a stage. Now, let me say this. Ambivalence is a state of simultaneous high, positive, and negative evaluation of an attitude or an object. Have you ever raised children? Then you have been ambivalent. Okay. And you'll notice this. This is the first thing that piqued our interest. Okay. When you look at those students who rate an online course in the middle, neutral, your assumption is that they are neutral. It couldn't be further from the truth. If you conducted a focus group, what you would see would be conflicting high positive and high negative feelings. It is a confluence of more emotion in that category than any other place. It's really, really interesting. Now, ambivalence is not the same thing as indifference or uncertainty, okay? Nor ambiguity. What's the difference between ambiguity and ambivalence? I don't know, and I don't care. All right, here we go. Ambivalence in our culture. It's everywhere. It is absolutely everywhere. You can see images of ambivalence wherever you look. They are everywhere. Begin looking. There are visual pictures of ambivalence everywhere. Gardner will be doing a session. Next session. You must go. You must go. It is called Cognitive Surplus or The Lonely Shallows. Is the Internet Making Us Stupid? Okay. He'll be doing a counterpoint on this. This is interesting. If you read the academic literature on technology, the sum total is ambivalence. It is ambivalence. We have a pile on the left that says utopia. We have a pile on the right that says dystopia. Who are we to believe? These people have made a wonderful cottage industry of disagreeing with each other. It's very interesting. It is very interesting, okay? Metaphors for ambivalence. There are so many metaphors for ambivalence in our society, you can't count them all. I mean, we speak through ambivalence and metaphors. Katrina Meyer wrote a wonderful, wonderful paper called Common Metaphors and Their Impact on Distance Education, what they tell us and what they hide. And she makes this point. Be very careful of the metaphor you select because it can constrain you. Once you select a metaphor, you can't understand alternative explanations. It's very, very interesting. So we have metaphors everywhere we look for ambivalence. What else do we have? In literature. There is ambivalence in literature. My goodness, yes, okay? Okonkwo in Things Fall Apart was ambivalent toward his adopted son. Edna Pelcher in The Awakening was ambivalent toward Victorian values. Doc Sportello in Ambient Findability was ambivalent toward Bigfoot. Okay. Toni Morrison, Sula. Okay. Nell was ambivalent toward Sula. Absolutely. And brothers Karamazov, Ivan, Dmitri, and Alyosha were ambivalent toward Father Karamazov. Absolutely. And if you're a fan of Tom Robbins, Sissy Hangshaw was ambivalent toward her thumbs. Absolutely. Then there is the student voice in ambivalence. A sample of that. A sample of the ambivalence. The case I'm trying to make is that there are always conflicting feelings. And our job here is to deal with them with our students and try to ameliorate those conflicting feelings. And we've noticed something interesting, too, that will come up. Okay, Patsy is going to show you some data about measuring quality.
Good afternoon. So I've got the I'm very ambivalent about being the data person in this presentation because you can see where Chuck's going and data is not as exciting as where Chuck goes. So what I want to show you is on our campus we regularly survey our students. And this is very typical of what we find for students in our fully online and blended courses. As Chuck said, part of our responsibility is evaluating the effectiveness or rather the impact of both our online and blended initiatives on our campus. What you see on the left is the students who are very satisfied. Generally are the majority of our students, nearly 50% for both blended and online. Students are very satisfied. They love these classes. What you see on the right is the students who are very unambivalent about not liking. This is not the mode for them. For whatever reason, they do not resonate with either the online or blended environment. Those students in the middle, then, are those who express some sense of ambivalence. What we find often is students will love the convenience of not coming to campus. But then on our surveys, they'll tell us that they miss the face-to-face interaction with their peers and with their instructor. So this is the kind of disconnect that students are having with these courses. Early on, we had a survey that we always share with you. We asked students, did you like your online course? No. Did you like the instructor? No. Did you feel that this helped your learning? No. Would you take another online class? Absolutely. And it comes back to the reason of the convenience. So there's this sense of ambivalence that we've seen repeatedly, which is part of the reason we started looking at this phenomena in our students. You know what it is. Basically, they're either satisfied, very satisfied, they love it, they hate it, or there's some counterpoised feelings in the middle, as Chuck said. In terms of measuring this, when we do our scaling, if you're at all familiar with the 5-point Likert scale, your strongly negatives and strongly positives are very low ambivalent. The highest ambivalent level is those people in the middle, and then you have those who have some positive feelings but are still negative, and some negative feelings but are still positive, that are more of the medium ambivalence. This is what it looks like in another form. And we're calling those students who answer on the extremes non-ambivalent, and in the center then some sense of ambivalence. So that's our student survey. Another data collection method that we have, which I'm sure all of you have on your campus, is what we affectionately term the form. This is our student evaluation of instruction. We all have one, right? And this is another way for our students to express their ambivalence with their individual classes. This is a list of a one-word description. If you translated these into actual phrases or sentences, it would give you the 16 items on our form. So there are 15 different things that are measured, and then the last would be the overall measure of the student's performance or student's assessment of the instructor in the class. So what we do is we look at our form and we try to find some patterns. For the students who are positively non-ambivalent, remember those are the ones that were very satisfied. They love online classes, and these are for the ratings of the online classes, by the way. If you are a faculty member and you get an excellent in facilitation of learning, and the student feels that you deserve an excellent in piquing the interest in their learning, then there's a 93% probability that you will get an overall rating of excellent. Now, on our campus, this can equate to teaching awards, to which involve money. I mean, this is a pretty significant thing in the portfolio. So we've done a lot more work, and we actually have a paper published on this if you're interested more in the student ratings, more detail. But today we're focusing on the ambivalent part. Those in the middle, as we look at those students who are more ambivalent, you see there's a lot more gray area here, right? So again, facilitation of learning. You can get a very good, or if the student feels you showed an interest in their learning, you can get anything but the extremes. Basically anything in the middle for that or organization, then you have a 66% probability of getting an positive ambivalent rating. So you're going to get a very good, basically. For those who get neutral ratings, you can see there's even more of a gray area here. So there's a 74% probability that if your facilitation of learning is anything average or higher, and you kind of bottom out on communication and showing respect for students, then the students are then going to be very neutral about rating you as well. On the negative extreme, we have the overall negative ambivalent. So this would be a poor, or a 2 if you're thinking Likert scale. You can, again, these same items are the ones that students are looking at as being important. But if they see that you have either a fair average on facilitation of learning, or you really are fair or worse on communicating and on organization of your class, then 74% probability that you're going to get a negative ambivalent rating. You can see, now, the final, for the non-negative or non-ambivalent, this would be the poor. All of a sudden, we go back up to 82%. The point being, students are very clear on what they see is excellent and what they see is poor. It's everybody in the middle gets a little bit more gray.
Thank you, Patsy.
What you can't see.
Now, what Patsy has just shown you, again, is think about this. Remember the form. Okay, the 16 items on the form. The criterion measure was the overall rating. And the analysis of the other 15 items on the scale, what she has just shown you is, and she said it very eloquently, that at the extreme ends of this, there's a lot of information contained. As you get closer and closer to the center, more to those ambivalent categories, you have much wider variability. So if you look at the ambivalent category, someone can give you a good and two poors, and you'll still get that neutral rating. So it carries a much wider variability. So it's much more difficult to place them all in a category that unifies them in some way or other. So that's what we're doing. Now, one of the things in this, online learning is the whole notion of what do we do with learning styles? What do we do with student learning styles? And that's another interesting thing. You know, there's a whole canon of literature that suggests that the study of learning styles is actually vacuous, that the study of learning styles tells you nothing about whether a student will achieve more or less in a course. And there's another whole school that says ENTJ is spoken here. Okay, ENT is spoken. You should do everything by learning styles. So what we've done is used ambivalence again. We've adopted a medical school model to understand the way students communicate in their classes and with their instructors and with each other. And it's based on adolescent theory. It comes from the University of Mississippi Medical School, and it's for the training of physicians of adolescents. And we use adolescent theory because there are so many adolescents running around on campus. And so many of them are faculty. Okay. I mean, come on, it's the best job in the world, isn't it? All right. Now, what it has done is, the theory basically is that as a student's ambivalence rises, that their communication patterns become more evident. And it's basically, if you're interested in this, you're more than welcome. We spent 12 years developing learning protocols, but it basically has to do with energy level students have and their need for dependence. And one type, let me tell you a type, the way we work with students. One type is called high energy level, aggressive, and independent. This kind of student really doesn't, they say everything that they feel. Whatever's on their mind, they say, and they're confrontational. They're very good at being confrontational. They're not mad, they're just confrontational. I am actually tutoring, well, in my statistics classes, an aggressive, independent student will say, I don't believe it, derive it. And I say, all right, I'll derive it. And I'm going up to the board saying, God, I hope I can derive it. You know, because if I don't, I've lost a student. Lost them. So, I'm tutoring a faculty son right now on the SAT. Tutoring on the SAT. And he's an aggressive independent. Says whatever he thinks. And he's confrontational. So, he said to me, stop. Chuck, I don't think we're doing too well. He calls me Chuck. Okay? I don't think you're that smart. Okay? You don't look like a professor. In fact, you look pretty goofy. That's exactly his words. Now, how do you handle a student like that? One is you don't schmooze them. So here's what I said to him. Rex, here's your problem. Your nose isn't big enough. Therefore, you're not getting enough oxygen to your brain, and you can't understand the SAT questions very well. Now, we had a hell of a fight. Okay? We had a hell of a fight. But we got over the fight, and we got over it, and we went on with our work. If I had tried to finesse him, I would have lost the student immediately. So we use this system. We use this system to try to understand student communication patterns and then maximize this and validate them in the classroom situation. If you're interested in it, you're more than welcome to our measurement protocol and how we work with it. We have developed ways to work with each of our types of students in the long protocol. So, I mean, when you have these questionnaires, it's very, very interesting. And when you look at these questionnaires, I'm always reminded of Hannibal Lecter, Agent Starling. You think you can dissect me with this simple little tool, you know, and it's true. It's true in terms of what happens. Okay. Now, let's look at it another way. Let's look at things you can't see. Now, stay with me. Now, we've got the form. We have the form. What we have then is students who are in one of five categories: the extreme positive, positive non-ambivalent, right? Very good, positive, but some problems. Middle category, all over the lot. Negative, but there's a couple of good things. I hate those ratings, you know? You suck, but you did a couple of things right. And the last one is terrible. Okay, those are the five categories. Now, we sort students on those, and we go back and look at the other 15 items. And what I'm doing in this analysis is looking at the factors, the actual underlying factors in those 15 items in each of those categories. So if you look at my diagram over here, the plum color, is that plum? Yes, plum. The plum color is the two non-ambivalents, very positive and very negative. Okay? The green are the positive, negative ambivalence, and the old yellow is just a plain old ambivalent. Some interesting things come out when you look at the underlying dimensions. Like I said up there, structure. What I'm saying is, let me give you an example. You look at the items that comprise structure, and they are: used class time well, was organized, there was continuity, the pace was good, and the objectives were well stated. It's a clear structure factor. Engagement, communication, expectations, availability, respect, interest, it's clear. Okay, so these are the underlying factors. So look at the pattern here. When they are non-ambivalent, there are a very few dimensions by which they rate the course. Very few. The more ambivalent they come, the more multidimensional it becomes. Isn't that interesting? When they're ambivalent about you, they rate you on more dimensions of your class and your behavior. Isn't that interesting? Now, another interesting thing, when I take those items and try to predict in a regression, a logistic regression, whether we will put you into the right category or not, look what happens. In the non-ambivalent categories, the prediction is very good. In the mid-ambivalent categories, the prediction gets weaker. And in the ambivalent category, it doesn't do very much to predict at all. Isn't that interesting? It interests me. I hope it interests you. Okay. Look at it in a blended environment. Look at it in a blended environment. Exactly the same thing. Exactly the same thing. Isn't that fascinating? So what happens is, at the extreme ends, they work. You know? If your cholesterol is 140, you're good. If your cholesterol is 190, you're bad. Or, you know, or 200, 210, you're bad. Okay? If it's in the middle, you don't know what to do. You don't know what to do. That's the problem with this. And our job here is, we hope to end the ambivalence. Now, we noticed some other things. We noticed some other things. Gardner and I have been reading two books. One is by, I'm sorry. Quality. We are challenged continually on the quality of these courses, are we not? Okay. Do you ever read Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance? Your generation is showing. Persig has a great quote in there. There is such a thing as quality, but every time you try to measure it, something goes haywire. You just can't do it. You know what I'm saying? It's hard to think. Remember Justice Potter? I can't give you a definition of pornography, but I know it when I see it. Definition of quality. Try this one on for size. Clarity, authenticity, utility, suspense, economy, depth, proportion, vividness, brilliance, sensitivity, emphasis, authority, flow, and precision. Isn't that nice? You know where that comes from? Zen. You know that book was turned down 121 times? And the publisher finally said, I'm going to give you $3,000 because it's the right thing to do, but don't ever expect to make another dime from this book. That's exactly what happened to him. But there are two theories in this. What causes ambivalence? This is Andrew Weigert's book, Mixed Emotions. These are the components, the progenitors, according to Weigert, of ambivalence. And it makes sense, doesn't it? All of these things. You know, uncertain, you know, even talks in the book about time. The way we conceptualize time causes us ambivalence. Gardner told me about a book by Paul Sylvia called The Psychology of Interest, where he identifies the components of interest, the progenitors of interest. Okay? Two different people, two different theories. Look at this. Look at Sylvia's progenitors of interest. Now, isn't that interesting? Do they look familiar? Ambivalence? Interest. Ambivalence? Interest. Fascinating. Two totally different theories, talking about two totally different things, using essentially the same constructs. Using essentially the same constructs. Could it be that ambivalence and interest are one and the same? Or that they overlap in some way or other? That these things that we view as negative really is sparking some sort of notion of interest in our students? Gardner?
So one of the most fruitful things about doing work with Chuck and Patsy is that anything that seems like a conclusion in sight endlessly becomes complicated, nuanced, subtle, and deep. And I wouldn't want it any other way. I'm convinced that a lot of the language of assessment is actually a tool to learn what we already know and reaffirm what we've decided before we get started. And then you get something like this, this weird overlap of ambivalence and interest, and you go down a rabbit hole. You've taken whatever color pill it is, I never keep track of them, in the matrix, that now you can't see the things you saw before. Instead, you think about things in a different way, and perhaps in a more fruitful way. So what I'd like to do is kind of round out the consideration here by thinking about interest with you, and what a strange thing it is. If it's true that interest leads you to a more multidimensional, ambivalent, uncertain, novel, conflicted, and complex view of the world, that's something perhaps we should pay attention to. Because I'm an English scholar, the first thing I do is go to the Oxford English Dictionary and find out where did this word come from. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "Language is fossil poetry." And I think that's true. It comes from the Latin word, interest does, inter esse. You probably recognize inter, right? International, interwoven, interrelated. Essa is the verb to be. So what is interest? Interest is between to be. Or to put it in a way that looks a little more like English, to be between. When Sylvia talks about the quality of novelty, for example, he says it's not that something is just brand new, it's that it falls in between two categories. You look at it, and you don't know whether it's this or that. You've never seen something in the middle in that way. And as Chuck's remarks have suggested, that is part of the quality of interest. It also maps onto ambivalence. The word further means taking part, participating. But participation has this interesting betweenness quality, if it's to be rich, if it's to be something that people value, if it's not to be a foregone conclusion. Many models of teaching having to do with content delivery and knowledge transfer are about foregone conclusions transmitted from teacher to student. Jerome Bruner says, no, quality has more to do with conjectures and dilemmas. That's what drives inquiry. Sylvia's work suggests it also drives interest. Ted Nelson in 1974 says, education ought to teach and reward initiative, curiosity, the habit of self-motivation, intellectual involvement. We all say we want this. We say we want a passion for lifelong learning. We want people to be self-directed, self-motivated, intrinsically motivated, not just want what the teacher wants, not just do what the teacher says. Well, computers were supposed to help with that. Nelson points a great irony. 36 years ago, educators and computer enthusiasts tend to agree on these goals, but what happens? Many of the inhumanities of the existing system, no less wrong for being unintentional, are being continued into computer-assisted teaching. If you want to close down ambivalence, if you want to foreclose on interest, a good computer-aided instruction module, a really airtight learning object, or a really lockstep curriculum can be scaled, automated, and made deadly. Theodore Sturgeon, who wrote a couple of my favorite Star Trek episodes, I don't care if I'm old, I fought for this age. Amok time, you remember when Spock ends up having to mate? If you haven't seen it, you should. It's quite the episode. Also, Shore Leave, where they go down, it's like Alice in Wonderland with all sorts of crazy things on the planet. Sturgeon wrote a lot of other great, great science fiction. He coined a symbol. Not everyone gets to do that. He made that up. It stands for Ask the Next Question, meaning you're not yet satisfied with what you've learned. There's something else. You need to ask another question. It's the thing that's so annoying that we drill it out of students. I'm sorry, I can't answer that question. There's no time. We have to cover more material. We have to cover the chapter today. Maybe you could come to my office and we could talk about it. Oh, please, I hope not. So what we end up with is Theodore Sturgeon believing so fully in this idea of asking the next question that by the last 24 years of his life or so, he would sign his name always with that little ask the next question symbol, eventually had it made into a piece of jewelry that he wore around his neck. So instead of interest, instead of in-betweenness, instead of taking part, we have education that looks like a pill minder, very clean, very unambivalent, very well organized. Or we have essentially workforce preparation, scaling very, very well. It's just content. It's just delivery. And you can do this really well online. Or if you want a really coherent curriculum in which each stage makes absolute sense, no conjectures, no dilemma, no ambivalence, no interest. You can have any color you want as long as it's black. And here's where we bolt on the foreign language. Here's where we bolt on the sociology requirement. Here's where we bolt on your ethics course, etc. At the end, you roll off the assembly line. Or worst of all, we have, to use a metaphor from sociologist Tim Clydesdale's first year out, a situation in which students just take their punishment. He says that students endure their liberal arts hazing when they come into their schools. And that's not a picture of ambivalence. That's pretty clearly not working well. I don't know which requirement that is. Maybe English composition being applied to his back at that point. But, you know, I have to stop and say, I can't tell you how many colleagues I have run into, students, friends, who say, you know, I'll never forget the humiliation I endured when I turned in my first English composition paper. I might have done something with math, but I was told, no, you have no ability, etc. I mean, you get the idea. You want to go to a clean conclusion. You want to sort things out well. That may not be anything to do with interest or with the joy of learning. Or you get what I call the I lie. This is just a screenshot from my institution, Baylor. Many of you have similar ones. These are portals, of course. The URL is my.baylor.edu, but it could be my.youruniversityhere.edu, and that's what students use to get to their course management system. It's not theirs. We force them to type that in, but it's not theirs. This is interestingness in another medium. This is Flickr, photo sharing service. They actually have a category they call interestingness. And how do they rate interestingness? By looking at activity in the network, in the in-between spots, in the inter-essa, the way people respond, link to, comment, feature on their own blogs, the way the network itself signals interest. My friend John Udell, who is working for Microsoft now but has had many, many different jobs, including a long stint as chief guru and tech writer at Byte Magazine, has a really fascinating and I think very touching way of talking about the network as a place between, as an ambivalent place, as a place that signals to itself that something interesting has happened. And I just want to play for you his remarks. They're very brief, but the way he describes it is in terms of neuroscience, as if the brain itself as a network is a place of ambivalence and interest.
But this notion of context as a service that we provide to one another was really the kind of the key thing. And there was a moment where this kind of crystallized for me. It's something that Dave Weiner talked about. I can't remember when, but you know what happened is that one day something interesting happened in the .NET space. And Dave noted it on his blog. But the thing was that Dave didn't really know too much about the .NET world. Right? He only knew that there was this blogger and that blogger and then the other blogger who he trusted as authorities in that space. And every once in a while, one of them would blog something, and he would say, oh, you know, that seems like it might be interesting. And another day, another one of them would pop up and say something. He would sort of take note of it. And then one day, all three of these guys fired at the same time, basically. And he went, aha, you know, that means by definition, something interesting and important happened in the .NET space today, right? Like, I just know that a priori because the network told me. And when I reflect on that now and when I talk about that now, I use the terminology that I use is summation. And, you know, I the term comes from biology, right? And it's what happens in a nervous system where you have, you know, three neurons impinging on a fourth, right? And the signal isn't going to propagate unless all three of the inputs fire. You know, one or two won't do it, right? So what I actually assert is that this human network that we're creating of contextual filters for one another is, in some sense, it's literally a nervous system, right? It's a nervous system writ large. And so, you know, PubSub for me is hugely important.
By PubSub, he means publication and subscription, and he's talking about in the .NET sphere, the blogosphere, which is wired so that when people are connecting or linking, this generates a series of trackbacks, it generates a series of alerts in your readers and so forth. And I think the connection is this, that if in this educational setting online and blended, we have a situation in which the network functions as context, filter, summation, when these students who are in these middle places, these interesting ambivalent places, are able to signal that to each other, then we will be learning. Then we will have something that can actually shape the experience. So I think about InterESSA again, and I think about the fact that it stands for the network outside of us. InterESSA stands for the network inside of us, our thoughts, our mixed feelings, our experiences, our interests, our networked minds. And I close with a thought from Stephen Berlin Johnson, who's got a new book out I recommend very highly to you. I've just started it, but already I'm in love. He had me at ideas. The title of the book is Where Good Ideas Come From, and his thesis is that chance, not the way Pasteur had it, favors the prepared mind, but that chance favors the connected mind. It is the extent to which interests, ambivalences, experiences are able to socialize with each other. These ideas connecting, those interstitial in-between spaces, able to signal to each other. It's that extent to which the mind becomes prepared to be able to take advantage of what life will bring it. And I think that's part of what we want education to do. Thank you.
You can see what we do to each other's minds. In closing, a couple of things is, one is, we're big fans of Jay Forrester at MIT and complex systems and systems dynamics. And if we've learned anything, it's these three adages. When you introduce an intervention into a complex system, you really can't anticipate how it will ripple through that system. You really cannot do that. Secondly, the results are often very counterintuitive. Here's an example of what we found is counterintuitive. The strongest feelings we find in our students are in that category that is neutral. The strongest positive and the strongest negative feelings reside there. Now, our next job is to conduct many, many focus groups and to try to tease them out, to try to tease them out. And lastly, there will always be side effects, both positive and negative. We're back to raising children. There will be positive and side and negative effects. My provost, Terry Hickey, who just retired, said when he thinks about this, when he thinks about ambivalence, he thinks about the next generation, he thinks about technology, he thinks about working with me, it doesn't bother him in the least. He sleeps like a baby. Sleeps for an hour, wakes up and cries for an hour, and so on and so forth through the evening. Now, in terms of where we would like to go with this, at the University of Central Florida, we are going to try to now dig out this ambivalence in a qualitative way and see if we can use it in a sense of ameliorating this ambivalence, moving them more to the positive in this, in the same with our faculty. And we're trying to have our faculty understand this as a, don't misinterpret this. Because someone is neutral doesn't mean that they're not involved in the course. They may be more involved in the course than you can imagine, than you can possibly imagine. So, with that, we would say to you, if you're interested in any of the things we are doing with the long protocols, you're more than welcome to them. We would love to work with you. I'm sure Gardner would love to work with you on any of these things. We have a few minutes for questions and answers, which is really not our speed. Okay? Are there any questions or comments? Have we completely destroyed you? If not, then we thank you for coming. Have a good conference.
Perhaps since we're a little bit early, you could go right to one of those email kiosks and fill out that evaluation so we get some feedback so we don't walk away from this too ambivalent. Fantastic. Thank you very much. Thank you.